In the coming week, countries continue to deal with the challenge presented by COVID-19. G20 foreign ministers and energy ministers convened virtually amid the pandemic, and Israeli struggles to form a governing coalition. It's April 9th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay.
And I'm Stephen Cook, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Stephen should be familiar to our longtime listeners, having guest hosted before. As a reminder, he is the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at CFR. He is the author most recently of the book False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. I want to note for listeners that Stephen and I are practicing physical distancing in recording this podcast from our respective homes. And because of that, we apologize in advance for any audio issues that may arise and if any of our family members make an unexpected appearance. So, Stephen, I hope that you and yours are all doing well during this challenging time.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be back and right back at you. I hope everything is well at the Lindsay household and beyond. Let's dive right in and kick off the podcast with discussing the coronavirus. You and I discussed the pandemic's impact throughout the Middle East and North Africa earlier this week on the World Next Week sister podcast, The President's Inbox. But can you tell us more about what's going on with the virus in other parts of the world?
Stephen, the message depends upon which part of the world you're looking at. When we talk about countries that recognized the challenge early on and acted, they continue to do well. I'm thinking here in particular of Taiwan, Singapore, and to some extent, South Korea. If you look at Singapore, it's a country which has a lot of traffic. It's a big entrepot to the world. A lot of trade goes through there. It has roughly one death per million due to the coronavirus. And again, this sort of figure of deaths per million gives you a way to try to sort of compare countries in terms of the challenges they face. If you look at Taiwan, that's under one death per million. South Korea is about four deaths per million. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that these countries were very sensitive and aware of the challenges that a new virus could pose. They had dealt with the challenge posed by SARS, a related coronavirus epidemic back in the early 2000s. And these countries sort of jumped on top of the issue early with testing and something called contact tracing. That is, go out and find out who infected people met with and get those people to self-quarantine and thereby to break the transmission of the coronavirus. When you go elsewhere, the picture's a lot grimmer. Europe, by some measures, is the hardest hit at this point. We've talked about this before. The virus made its way there, became rooted in the community, and we see particular challenges in Spain and Italy. If you look at Spain, it's faced with roughly now 326 deaths per million people. Italy's at about 292, France, 167. And you look particularly at the United Kingdom, the number's 105 and is rising sharply. And I think we saw this week that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was hospitalized in intensive care because he had contracted COVID-19.
Reports are he's doing better these days, but it really is a stark contrast between the way in which these Asian countries have managed this problem and the way in which the Europeans, having not really dealt with or had to deal with SARS or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome and other coronavirus and others, left them essentially flat-footed to the ravages of COVID-19.
Well, you're right, Stephen. And here the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure applies. By the time Europe realized it had a problem, it was much harder to contain the virus. Also, you get into differences in the demographic profile of countries. Europe, on the whole, tends to be older. One thing we know about this virus is that it tends to hit harder at older populations and the like. Obviously, Europe now is really trying to play catch up and contain the consequences of the virus. I think the same thing really applies here in the United States. The death toll is now past 15,000. That translates into about 45 deaths per million. Now, there's some positive signs that perhaps the physical distancing and stay-at-home directives that have been in place in a number of cities and states around the country maybe flattening the curve. I think that's particularly the case in New York. And that, I think, is going to immediately kick off that debate about when normal life can resume. When can we go back to going to work and going to the mall and seeing Major League Baseball and the rest?
I hope it's sooner rather than later, because I do miss going to the office. But I'm worried that if states lift their states of emergency and their stay-at-home orders too soon, there'll be a second wave. We saw some of that. I read a piece about Spain, where it had a dip in the number of deaths per day. And then there was some slight loosening of restrictions. And then you had a tremendous uptick again. And in a place like Hong Kong, where they've loosened restrictions, they're having a spike in cases. Same thing in Japan. So it strikes me, at least, that any talk of lifting stay-at-home orders or anything along those lines strikes me in places like Europe, in the United States, are way, way too early.
You're putting your finger, Stephen, on what I think is a current and growing debate in the United States. That is, when can you let up and how do you factor in the economic consequences of the shutdown, of the stay-in-place orders? Obviously, big impact on the U.S. economy. This morning, more data came out about unemployment. It's going through the roof. And there's real concern about how well companies, whether large or small, can fare if they can't be open to sell their products and to make some profit and make some revenue. So this is likely to be the big debate over the next month or so, because you're quite right. As people see a flattening of the curve, if we in fact are getting one, there's going to be a greater push to say, okay, let's go back to life as normal. And as you point out, the virus, if it is given a chance to spread, it will spread. And then, of course, here we get into some of the great unknowns, which is it the case that as seasons change, it gets warmer, that transmission is going to go down? Some people say yes, some people say no. We really don't know as to what extent people have been infected and had mild or no symptoms. That obviously plays into how rapidly the disease can transmit in the future, to what extent the virus itself may mutate, which means even if you've had it already, you may not have immunity in the future. So there's a lot of scientific issues that are really up in the air. And then, of course, you get into the whole issue of what treatments work, when should those treatments be applied, who might they work with. A lot of doctors and scientists doing a lot of great work trying to figure that out. But all of that stuff takes time.
And all of this underlines exactly what the lesson is that we should all learn from the relatively successful cases, South Korea, Taiwan, others, that widespread testing, diagnostic testing, other types of testing is extremely important if we want to get out of the house sooner rather than later. Jim, let's turn our attention now to the Group of 20. G20 member states' finance ministers are scheduled to meet virtually on April 15th, which follows a meeting of the G20 energy ministers, who are set to convene virtually on Friday, April 10th. So what do you expect from these meetings? Is there going to be all coronavirus all the time, or are there other issues that are likely to crop up during these important meetings?
The coronavirus is going to play a role in both meetings, Stephen, more so, I think, in the finance ministers meeting than in the energy ministers meeting. Let's take the finance ministers meeting first. The finance ministers met at the end of March virtually again to talk about how the group should respond to the challenges posed to the global economy by the coronavirus. What it did was to task essentially working groups to come up with some plans, action plans, to address in particular the question of the debt vulnerabilities of the poorest countries. And that is to take some steps to particularly help emerging economies face with the consequences of a global downturn. And here's where, when we talk about the virus, its impact is not simply on health around the world, but also on the health of economies. And the countries that are poor are probably going to take an even bigger hit than advanced industrial economies, because many of these countries, one, have fragile economies to begin with, but they're also economies that depend very heavily on selling commodities. And obviously, if you have a global slowdown, people buy less economies, people buy fewer commodities, and as a result, your revenues go down. Many of these countries also have a fairly high level of debt that they have to pay or service, and then they end up in a situation which no revenue coming in, they're hard-pressed to actually pay back their debts. And that is why the G20 finance ministers are going to be spending a fair amount of time trying to figure out how to address what is likely to be an emerging debt crisis. This is not a problem that is going to be felt equally across the developing world. Some countries are in a greater degree of difficulty than others. I will note that Iran is already in conversations with the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, about potential financial help. I think it is conceivable that Turkey, a country you know a lot more about than I do, will find itself in need of some external help, given how fast the Turks are going through their reserves of foreign currency and the like. This is going to be a big issue going forward.
Indeed, Turkey was already likely in need of help from the IMF. But here's the question, and your commodity point is an interesting and important one, given what we've seen in the oil markets recently. But let that set that aside for a moment. Given the fact that the coronavirus doesn't respect borders and doesn't say, ah, this is a wealthy country and this is a poor country. And all of the advanced industrialized countries are struggling themselves with trying to contain this pandemic and spending lots and lots and lots of money. What is the financial wherewithal of the G20 countries to provide support to poorer countries who, as you quite rightly point out, are likely to take a tremendous hit as a result of the essentially the screeching halt of the global economy?
Well, the capacity, Stephen, still remains very high. The question is whether the will and interest will be there. And I think one of the things we are clearly seeing over the course of this pandemic is that the trends of the last decade toward more nationalism, more self-interest, less global cooperation are being accentuated by the pandemic. There's much more of a sense of every country has to look out for itself. And you know, that's been the general trend of nationalism. We've seen this just in the level of which countries have been competing with one another to get medical supplies. Obviously, internally, domestically, nationalism, populism is on the rise. So even where you have leaders who might be interested in doing things for poorer countries, they can have a political problem. Why are you providing masks or physical protection equipment to people overseas when you have a big problem at home? Now, ideally, what something like the G20 can do is to bring countries together to work on cooperating. Now, the G20 really sort of made its mark during the great financial recession of 2008-2009, where, in essence, its great strengths, the ability to represent the economies of the biggest countries in the world, really came to play. I think over the last, certainly 5 years, the G20 has sort of not been as important, and we really haven't seen the G20 rise to the forefront. And one of the reasons is that you don't have a country acting in a leadership role driving the G20. I think the Chinese may have some ambitions to do so.
Right, right.
It's clear the Trump administration doesn't see that global leadership role of the United States that was traditional as something it wishes to play. And so I think what you're going to have is a lot of countries sort of acting on their own, not coordinating terribly much. Even if you look at the European Union, Stephen.
You took the words right out of my mouth. The European Union, the fact that there hasn't been as much cooperation, that the Italians have had to beg from their neighbors, and their neighbors have said, no, we're not going to provide you the equipment that you need, I think laid bare the weakness of the European Union and this idea of countries coming together in a way that can effectively fight the virus and do other things in concert. And so I fear that as you point out, there may be resources available from the G20 countries via the IMF, but the political will just isn't there. I mean, the whole idea behind European integration was to address these kinds of crises in a way that do not lead to tensions and worse between states and the European continent.
And I'll just note on the European Union, Stephen, obviously, it is in many ways the most successful supranational organization out there. I mean, again, it was purposely designed to bring these countries together, and it's showing great divisions. Once you get beyond the European Union, obviously, there's no other place we see that level of intergovernmental cooperation. We also mentioned the energy ministers' virtual meeting. I think here, the discussion will have in the background the fact that the pandemic is slowing down the global economy, and that has led to a drop in demand. That explains why global oil prices have fallen by more than half since the beginning of the year. But the real issue on the energy front is this price war that's going on between the Saudis and the Russians. And that issue is not going to be settled at the G20. It's really going to be settled when either Moscow or Riyadh blinks. And so far, neither capital looks like it is willing to blink. Again, the background issue is that the Saudis wanted the Russians to cut production to help support the price of oil. And the Russians said, no, thank you. And the Saudis said, well, we're tired of having to cut back our supply to prop up the price. So we're going to go the other way and we're going to increase our production. And that's what has really sort of driven down the price of oil. And this has created problems for countries all around the world. I'll just note, I was having a conversation with somebody who follows Mexico quite closely and said that at least last week when the price of oil dipped down to about $20 a barrel, that it actually would cost the Mexicans more to produce a barrel of oil than it could sell that barrel of oil for on the international market. But we when you sort of multiply that, other countries like Nigeria, Angola, this gets back to that point about countries being dependent upon the sale of oil on commodities. When those prices go down, their position gets a lot harder.
And some of those countries cannot shut down their oil fields, because if they do, they can never start them back up because of lack of maintenance or just the kind of physical aspects of those oil fields. Now, there is some good news. At least the oil market believes that there is a deal between the Russians and the Saudis. There is a meeting today of OPEC Plus, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, plus 10 other countries, including Russia. The United States is also represented there. And there was expectation that there would be some agreement on a production cut, which was what precipitated this price war. But I'll tell you, it is not going to fix the problem between the Saudis and the Russians. And the Saudis are particularly sensitive about being played for the sucker by the Russians. They feared that they would have agreed with the Russians would cheat on their production cuts, and the Saudis would lose on both revenue as well as on market share, which was one of the reasons why they said that they were going to pump more at a cheaper price in order to protect their market share. Whatever this deal that seems to be emerging is coming forward, it's going to be important that there be some sort of mechanism in which everybody adheres to it. But we know from the history of OPEC that the impetus to cheat and grab market share at the expense of others in the cartel is so great that we may be back to another oil price war relatively soon.
Well, that's the basic law of cartels. You can form them. They can work in the short run, but everybody has an incentive to cheat. And unless you have some clear enforcement mechanism, and there isn't one in the case of OPEC, it falls apart. Just two quick points in this, Stephen. I think it's important to flag for people. One is that the cost of producing oil varies greatly across countries.
That's
a country
right.
like Saudi Arabia is a very low-cost producer. Many other countries, the cost of producing their oil, think of the oil sands in Canada, much higher. And so, you know, Saudi Arabia can put up with a lower price of oil for a lot longer than many other countries have. The other thing is that people will say, well, why don't you just pump it and store it? And that's what a lot of companies and countries are doing right now. The problem is you can very quickly run out of storage,
right.
for that oil. And that's why
I read one report that said you can run out of storage space on the globe by May. So yes, it's far more expensive. Canadian tar sands, Venezuela is more expensive. Yep. The United States is relatively more expensive. One of the reasons why the Russians didn't initially agree to a cut was because they wanted to do damage to American shale producers who have played such an important role in the changes to the global energy market. So we'll just have to see whether this thing sticks. But my contacts within Saudi Arabia suggest to me that they are at a heightened state of awareness when it comes to the Russians and their willingness to cheat, and that the trust between Russia and Saudi Arabia, while maybe not as high as some might have made it out, there was a deal in place beginning in 2016, and that trust that has lasted this time is gone, and the feelings there are kind of raw.
Okay, so the arguments I was hearing for the past 2 to 3 years about the new emerging access between Riyadh and Moscow, that's no longer the case, Stephen?
Well, you know, later today or sometime tomorrow, my next column in foreignpolicy.com will appear, and it argues exactly that this idea that there was going to be some sort of Russian-Saudi axis in the Gulf was really a function of people making broad arguments from basically this one area of overlap between Saudi Arabia and Russia. The ideas about a new global order and the Russians and the Chinese playing a greater role in ordering it may or may not be the case. And here's an example where people had expectations about the Russians. And I think the Russian-Saudi moment was an extremely brief one.
Okay, since we're talking about the Middle East, Stephen, let me move you a little bit to the west of the Persian Gulf and talk about another country you know something about, and that's Israel. It has gone through 3 elections in the last year, most recent one being in early March. The results of each election were, I guess, indecisive, at least in terms of forming a government because neither of the major parties or coalitions won a majority. So you have to go through the arduous task of assembling a coalition. Just last week, the leader of one of those coalitions, Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Coalition, did something he said he would never do. He agreed to join a national unity government with Prime Minister Netanyahu. But my understanding is that we still don't have an Israeli government. What's going on, Stephen?
Israeli politics is really quite something, Jim, I have to say. Every time you think it's going to be settled, something else props up. So here's a quick background for our listeners who don't pay as much attention to this. Last weekend, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with Benny Gantz, the leader of the Blue and White Coalition, and apparently struck a deal for an emergency coronavirus government. As an aside, Israel has almost 10,000 cases and 79 Israelis have died of COVID-19. So the crisis really gave impetus to discussion of a national unity government. So they met at the prime minister's residence, and after some hours of discussion, a deal was made. Benny Gantz and the Blue and White Coalition would concede on the question of annexation of West Bank territory, something that they had opposed, although I think parts of the Blue and White Coalition, including Benny Gantz himself, understood that what everybody in Israel seems to understand is that there will be some Israeli annexation of the West Bank in some sort of final deal between Israel and the Palestinians. Then, for his part, Prime Minister Netanyahu would allow Gantz and his coalition to name members of a committee that appoints judges. Like here in the United States, there is an ideological battle over the judiciary, and Gantz and his people have opposed what they see as judges on the right rolling back democratic principles and practices in favor of a kind of more nationalist agenda, let's say. This was the deal. Everybody was going forward. The press was going to announce it on Monday, April 6th. And suddenly, Prime Minister Netanyahu reneged because his partners to the right of him, who would be part of this coalition, were in revolt over the issues of the judges and the judiciary. And the whole thing seems to have fallen apart. Meanwhile, the Blue and White Coalition has crumbled over the agreement that Gantz made with Netanyahu. A important part of that coalition, a party called Yesh Atid, which means there is a future, led by a guy named Yair Lapid, bolted from the Blue and White Coalition, or at least for now, bolted from the Blue and White Coalition. So now, if you can follow this, now that there doesn't seem to be a deal, even though there was a deal, Prime Minister Netanyahu may be more interested in a fourth election for a few important reasons. The first being that Gantz actually underperformed in the third election. It wasn't enough of an underperformance for Netanyahu to be able to form a coalition outright, but he did not do as well as he did in the second election. Second reason, as I pointed out, the Blue and White Coalition has now split, and this has weakened Gantz and that coalition. And then finally, Netanyahu's handling of the coronavirus crisis is polling actually pretty well. Just by way of anecdote, I have Israeli friends who are not Likud voters, never have been Likud voters, not fans of the prime minister, who have relayed to me how they think that the prime minister is handling the situation quite well and would prefer him to be the prime minister during the coronavirus crisis than any of the other possible contenders. So Netanyahu can read polls. Netanyahu can see that Blue and White and Gantz have been weakened as a result, and we may be heading towards a fourth election in Israel.
My oh my, Stephen, that's all I can say. My oh my.
This is truly unprecedented in Israeli history, and people were writing off Netanyahu, and he seems to be the cat that has 18 lives, forget 9 lives. So his supporters call him the King of Israel. If he pulls this off and there is a fourth election and he wins and is able to form a government, I think everybody's going to have to concede the point that he is indeed the King of Israel.
He is certainly a political survivor. I'll leave it at that. Stephen, this is the time of the show where we normally do our figures of the week. So I'm going to ask you, who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, thanks. My figure of the week is a number, and it's 82.13, 82.13. And that is the number of tests per thousand that Iceland has undertaken. It's the highest number in the world. Obviously, Iceland's a very small country with a small population, has a lot of state capacity. It's got 1,600 cases and only 6 deaths. There was recently a story in the Washington Post how another small country, New Zealand, is not only flattening the curve, but I think the headline was not only is New Zealand flattening the curve, but it's crushing the curve. And I think Iceland is another case of a country crushing the curve. I don't think, though, given the demographic differences between Iceland and, for example, India, and the special challenges that a country of a billion people face that Iceland doesn't, I don't think, however, it undermines the idea that the way, absent a vaccine, absent medication that will help people who develop COVID-19, that really among our best defenses, in addition to physical distancing, is to test, 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 and retest, and retest, and retest. And that number of 82.13 people per 1,000 who've been tested is incredibly important. And I think it's something that, again, absent a vaccine or appropriate drugs, it's something that we're going to, around the world, have to ramp up and do if we want to get back to any sense of normalcy.
Well, obviously, Stephen, vaccines are probably 18 months away. They do take time to develop and test to make sure that you're not creating other health problems. What I'll be interested in seeing is how quickly countries can roll out tests to see if you have had coronavirus. Because right. If this is a virus where if you've had it, you have some immunity, that would change things because then people could find out whether they had had it. And again, from what we know, some portion, not insignificant portion of people have been exposed to the coronavirus and been asymptomatic. So obviously, if you knew what your status was and if there were reason to believe that having contracted disease gives you immunity, that would change things as well. But I think that's, again, something that is still in the air, still being developed and being worked through.
Well, let's hope it's sooner rather than later. Jim, what's your figure of the week?
Stephen, my figure of the week is a person, and I am going with Joe Biden. And I am flagging the former vice president because this week he became the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party when Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders ended his campaign. And Biden now has the way open to challenge President Trump. All of the many, many barrels of ink that were spilled writing about a contested convention in Milwaukee in what was supposed to be July, but it's now going to be August. All of those articles you read, you can simply forget about them because you're going to have a Democratic candidate nominated on the first ballot. And as I sort of look at the campaign, I mean, the immediate challenge for Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, is can he get heard? I mean, what I've been struck by is when I picked up the paper, I looked at several papers this morning, there was nothing about the presidential campaign on the front pages or the first several pages. And again, usually at this time of the year, in an election year, you will have stories on the front page about the challenger, what they're doing, what they have said. Again, the problem for Biden is that he's having trouble sort of cutting through all the news about the coronavirus, whereas President Trump is on cable news channels every night talking about what the government is doing. And so there's that differential. I think the longer term challenge for Biden is going to be what kind of world is he going to inherit if he succeeds in becoming president, and what policies would be wisest. I don't know how different the world is going to look 10 months from now, but I think it's going to look a bit different. And the question is, how well can the former vice president adapt to that changed world and also sort of change politics here at home? I mean, one of the ironies about Bernie Sanders leaving the race is that he's leaving the race as many of the issues that he had spoken about, social inequalities, inequities in the country, are being exposed by the coronavirus.
That's exactly right. I mean, all of my networks of friends and colleagues, we have been burning up the WhatsApp and Signal and texts on these questions of social inequality and all the things that coronavirus has really brought to the fore. The one thing that I wonder about the former Vice President Joe Biden is, how do you campaign in an environment like this? Yeah. You said, how does he get heard? But can former Vice President Biden go out on the hustings? Can he meet and greet people? Dr. Anthony Fauci said in an interview yesterday, he hopes that the handshake is a thing of the past. Presidential candidates have been shaking millions and millions of people's hands as long as we've been having presidential elections. So that is, I think, a huge challenge to the Biden campaign. Now the pathway is clear, but how is he going to campaign?
And you're obviously right. For people who've been following the campaign, Stephen, if you have seen President Trump at the White House with these daily press briefings, with the image in the background and the reporters asking him questions, and you compare that to Vice President Biden's live cast, I mean, there's just a real image differential there. And I think it's going to be a real challenge for the Biden campaign team to figure out how you reach people in ways that will seem presidential to them. And I think that's going to be a really big challenge.
Absolutely. Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. North Korea convenes a session of the People's Assembly of Pyongyang. We'll also be marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 13 launch and the first anniversary of the overthrow of former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is also coming up.
Stephen, breaking news bulletin here. I just happened to look at my email and there's a news alert from the Wall Street Journal reporting that the Russians and the Saudis have in fact agreed on a deal in principle to cut oil output. Any quick reaction?
Well, this is what the markets were expecting and what the players were signaling. It's good news for everybody in the short run. But I wonder if this deal, given the mistrust between the two governments, whether it's something that's durable.
Time will tell, Stephen.
Certainly will.
Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, Catherine Poppy, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Stephen Cook saying so long.